There were two obvious kinds of damage to black people that the civil rights reforms of recent decades could not remedy. The first is the deep damage to black self-esteem inflicted by chattel slavery and Jim Crow. Kenneth Clark and his wife Mamie were social psychologists who documented this with their famous doll experiments in the late 1940s, as depicted on the cover of our Order of Service today. Handed a white doll and a black doll and asked various questions about them, black children attributed positive qualities to the white doll and negative qualities to the black doll. Dick Sherman's testimony today underscores this. The message delivered to black people by the white culture of Williamsburg in the early 1960s was one of loathsomeness. What other meaning could a black person make of being confined in a roped-off section of the local theater? Local white dentists refused to treat black patients. They considered them untouchable. So did the white director of employment at Colonial Williamsburg. The loathsome chore of dealing with black people was turned over to a black director of black employment. So did the president of William & Mary, who prohibited attendance by black people at any meeting held on the William & Mary campus in the 1960s. All of this was occurring against a backdrop of similar messages of loathsomeness from the state of Virginia, whose racial purity laws had dehumanized any person with a single drop of black blood in his veins. It was a crime for a black person, even a one-drop black person, to marry a white person in Virginia in the 1960s. The civil rights legislation of the 60s made a huge difference in legal terms. But as we heard in Eileen O'Brien's testimony this morning, many of the social attitudes about race were still largely intact many, many years later. The second kind of unremedied damage to black people from racism is the cumulative crippling effect of chattel slavery and Jim Crow on the wealth accumulating capacities of black people. As a nation, we walked off the job of dismantling racism with it only half done. With respect to land, labor, and government programs designed to foster wealth accumulation, black people have been stolen from, cheated, and excluded outright. They were barred from land grant programs for settlers migrating westward. Social Security excluded the only categories of employment available to most black people. The GI Bill, widely hailed as colorblind, was administered so as to minimize the benefit of it for black veterans. In many areas of the country, redlining by banks and insurance companies locked blacks out. They locked them out of opportunities for home ownership, a critical building block of wealth accumulation in America. From generation to generation, whites have handed down wealth accumulated by the commission of these gross injustices. Blacks have been left with little or nothing to bequeath to their children. These practices have been outlawed, but the effects of the crippling of wealth accumulation by black people don't disappear in a few generations. Today, the average African American family holds a dime's worth of wealth for every dollar of wealth held by white families. Wealth affects education, which of course affects income. In Williamsburg today, nearly half of the black population have incomes of less than $25,000 a year, which clusters them right around the very stingy federal poverty level. The comparable poverty level figure for whites is a little over 10%. In our town, we have one of the largest racial disparities in income of all localities in Virginia. Did you get that? The poverty level for blacks is 4 times higher than for whites in our town. For all the progress we've made, racism is still very much with us. And its damage to black self-esteem is too. In 2006, just after the death of Kenneth Clark, a young videographer repeated his doll experiment and got the same results. You can see it on YouTube. It's hard to watch. Racism is a matter of actions and inactions, but also of attitudes. In white America, a racist agenda was pursued against black people for hundreds of years. We are perpetuating that agenda by leaving the crippling of wealth accumulation unaddressed. This, in turn, perpetuates the problem of low black self-esteem, which is an internalized racial attitude. White people must take responsibility for these actions and inactions. And I'm finally getting to the point of feeling that responsibility personally. At the same time, it seems to me that the actual dismantling of the internalized racial attitude of low self-esteem must remain primarily the work of the black community, which might or might not choose to ask for involvement from whites. In parallel to this work, I have my own spiritual work to do concerning internalized racial attitudes. I've gone through life showing very little curiosity about race. I don't mean idle curiosity. I mean the engaged curiosity of a person who lives as if he belongs to the world and the world belongs to him. A person for whom knowing the world as beautiful and broken is part of coming to know himself. I haven't looked at the whiteness of the patterns of my daily life and asked, isn't this unnatural? Could a random scattering in the population produce a life pattern like mine? If it's a holdover from old racist patterns, what should I be doing about that? If it's a matter of my choices, why am I making those? What is it costing me to live a life confined to these orbits? Jennifer and I do talk about racism, which she has felt as a person of Asian birth and still feels in her life. But usually it's more a discussion about her history than mine. I don't like to say it, but I see in myself that pattern of conceiving of racism as a problem that only affects people of color, rather than as a collection of spiritually costly attitudes hurting whites as well. I've acted as if racism isn't part of my life, but it is. It's just that in my life, it doesn't present a constant set of challenges as racism does for black people, because in my life, it's an inobtrusive, self-maintaining set of material privileges. Speaking of days gone by, Dick Sherman talked about blacks in Williamsburg knowing much more about whites than whites did about blacks. I hate to say this too, but that applies to me today. I don't know much about black people in my community because I don't have to. I don't have to if all I'm concerned about is cruising along through life. But for years now, I've been saying I'm committed to a spiritually awakened life. I can't continue to leave racism out of that spiritual awakening. I can't just shrug and say, I already have enough complexity and bewilderment and challenge in my life. I can't deny the part of me that Mary Oliver was talking about in her mourning poem when she said, there is still somewhere deep within you a beast shouting that the earth is exactly what it wanted. I'm not a troubled guest on this earth. I belong here. To be here fully, I have to open my heart to the entirety of the given world exactly as it is, unedited, uninsulated, unbleached. With a grounding in what is, I can be part of the imagining of what could be, a new mythology to replace our old one about race. We live our lives within overarching stories of community, culture, and country. These larger stories are powerful. Over time, they get so powerful, they seem to be telling and shaping us more than we're telling and shaping them. Stories have the power to wound and to heal, because lies always wound and truth always heals. The racist stories out of which we have lived for generations are false and wounding to all of us. Telling the truth about ourselves, even painful truth, is a healing form of self-love. Racism is an outgrowth of one small fact. An innocuous black pigment called melanin found in the cellular structure of animals and humans. Differences in melanin content among the populations of different geographical regions appeared long ago as an evolutionary response to variations in their exposure to sunlight. That's it. On this slender fact, human beings have constructed a mythological architecture of lies about race that falsely associate color with just about every essential aspect of being human. Intelligence, beauty, peacefulness, conscientiousness, responsibility, on and on. If our myth-making capacity is this prodigious, to have erected all that out of one small intersection between biology and environment, think of the soaring narrative we could fashion from the transformative work of ending racism. The new chapters we need to write in our stories about race can't start on a blank page. They have to be connected to the old chapters, like the ones we're talking about during Black History Month. Otherwise, the story doesn't hang together, and we can't live out of it. And these stories have to be co-authored. There will be no recovery of the authorship we have lost to racism until we recognize that we are all living out of one overarching story, as radically different as our individual parts in it and heritages from it have been. Story is what widens or narrows the pool of light. In today's call to worship, I asked, who is waiting to be inaugurated? I was thinking of black people who have been kept in shadow by racism. But by the time I finished preparing for this morning, the answer had changed on me. Many people, some black and some white, are yet to be inaugurated in different ways. When I asked the question, I really didn't grasp that I am one of those people. It's time for me to step out of the old story of racism, out of the shadow into which even white people are kept by the blinding whiteness of that story. And that's the healing truth for me. Amen.